You're listening to TIP.
Today, I'm pleased to be joined by the brilliant author Edward Chancellor to discuss his new book, The Price of Time. What is the price of time? It's very simple and it's very complicated. The price of time is the interest rate. In this interview, we're starting the story behind the interest rate and how it has caused boom and bust throughout time. And my favorite part is whenever we talk about John Law, perhaps the most legendary character in all financial history. Sometimes reality exceeds imagination, and the story of John Law is no different. Let's just say that boring, of all words, is not how you want to describe him.
You are listening to The Investors Podcast, where we study the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected.
Welcome to The Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Brodersen, and I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Edward Chancellor today. Edward, welcome to our show.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave.
Edward, let me just jump right into the first question here today. It's about Mesopotamia. What a wonderful way to start an outline. Today's modern-day Iraq, they charge interest rates on loans before they discovered how to put wheels on carts. We know this because Mesopotamians recorded their loans on clay tablets. When debt was settled, the tablets was destroyed. And luckily for historians and student histories, they didn't destroy them if they were unsettled. And I guess that was also sad for the debtors and creditor. So it seems like a lot of debt was unsettled. But interest was generally paid in the same commodity as loan, so commonly silver and barley. And we know that the Babylon king Hammurabi regulated the maximum interest of loan to silver to 20% and barley to 33.33%. With that as a backdrop to our conversation today, there is no doubt that interest has played a crucial role in societies throughout time. Even the Bible mentioned interest rates. And in the Bible, we also learn about debt jubilee. So let's start there. What is debt jubilee and why is it important for a well-functioning society, perhaps even today?
A debt jubilee is an official forgiveness of debt by the government, by the ruler. And we find debt jubilees across the ancient world. In Mesopotamia, it became common when a new ruler took power to forgive the barley debts, but not the silver debts. So the barley debts, one could assume, went largely to farmers. And then one finds debt jubilees decreed in ancient Israel at a period of, I think, a regular period of 50 years. You get forgiveness of debts in ancient Greece by the lawgiver Solon. So we have these either linked to the change of regime, a regular time period, or a sort of one-off. And why do they have debt jubilees? Because one of the problems that people have noted about interest since its early origins is that interest can compound over time, and that the compounding of interest leads people to get into greater and greater debt. In the ancient world, that often meant that the debtor would fall into a position of debt, bondage, and slavery. So the forgiving of the debts was a way of leveling, of bringing, you know, this great pile, mountain of debt back to a level and start again. And yeah, so that I think is the main reason for the jubilee. Why do we need it today? Well, I mean, it's only a fringe notion that debt should be forgiven today. And occasionally that's called, there've been calls, I think, you know, 20 odd years ago, to forgive debt to less developed countries. But our debt, the modern debt jubilee, really occurs through inflation, what we call, you know, what the economists call financial repression, by keeping interest rates actually below the level of inflation. The principal of the debt gets paid off. So we have a sort of sneaky protracted debt jubilees. You could say that, you know, this year, even though interest rates are going up, inflation is much higher. So obviously the real value of the principal owed in debts is shrinking. So you could say we're at the early stages of an ongoing debt jubilee.
It definitely would make headlines if we said, let's just forgive all debt. But as you said, we found another way of not saying it, but still doing it.
Towards the end of the book, I do mention the case of Iceland after the 2008 crisis. And there, Iceland, probably no country on earth, had borrowed as recklessly as the tiny country of Iceland during the global credit boom, running up foreign liabilities of 10 times Icelandic GDP. And much of the debt that they ran up was wasted on poor investments. After the financial crisis, the Icelandic government put the major banks into receivership and into runoff mode and actually defaulted on their foreign debt. So sort of a default is another way of a debt jubilee. And as I mentioned, Iceland going down this route actually recovered much more rapidly than the US or the European countries that went down the different route that we'll discuss later of sort of quantitative easing and low interest rates.
So Edward, let's still stay in time of history. Let's talk about Seneca the Younger, born 4 BC. He's primarily known as the Stoic philosopher in ancient Rome, I guess today. And I find it fascinating how he's thinking about time and how that is related to his views on interest, not only because he is painfully inconsistent, but he still said a bunch of interesting things about it. How did Seneca think about interest rates and how is that perhaps relevant today?
Well, I'm not sure if Seneca directly addressed the question of interest. There is a sort of inconsistency about Seneca, where he advocates, as you say, a stoicism, really an unworldly position. But at the same time, he was tutor to the Emperor Nero and he amassed a great fortune. He gave lavish parties. He lent his money with a group of people, group of other Romans, into Britain. And apparently it's said that when Seneca and his friends called in their loans, it was that that triggered the famous British revolt of Queen Boudica. But I think that what Seneca does say, and this becomes very important later on, is that time is man's most precious possession. And the important thing about interest and why I called the book The Price of Time, interest is really putting a price on how we spend our time. And Seneca's notion that time is man's possession is revived in the Renaissance period in Italy. It's at that moment people then begin more overtly to justify the practice of interest as a use of time, the use of capital over a period of time. I think that's the sort of main lesson that one takes from Seneca.
And history tends to repeat itself, or at least it tends to rhyme, as is often being said. We already talked here about the Babylon King and how he tried to regulate interest rates. You also mentioned in a wonderful book, Queen Elizabeth in 1571, signing into law the cap interest rate at that time around 10%. And yet here we are today and regulators are still trying to solve for the ever relevant challenge of so-called fair level of interest on loans. It's always tricky whenever you use the word fair, I should say that. But how can we think about monetary value across time? And what is the concept that economists call income smoothing?
So the time value is linked to humans' natural impatience that we prefer to have things sooner rather than later. But also, if you're engaged in any economic activity, if you say you have a factory, you're producing something, sooner and quicker you can produce things, the more profitable you're likely to be. And providing, obviously, you keep your costs under control. And so there is an incentive, or at least there should be an incentive, to use your time wisely. In fact, actually, although I didn't mention it in the book, I came across the other day the concept of something called demurrage. That derives from the verb to demur, or to slow. And apparently in medieval Europe, ships were fined. They fined a demurrage charge if they took a long time unloading their goods in the port. So you see, everything is linked. An efficient economy is sort of driven by a charge on time. And if we don't have any charge on time, we will tend to do things more, you know, to take too much time. As for income smoothing, when people are young, they can expect their income to grow over time, and therefore people say, for instance, students going to university will borrow and then pay back those debts over time. And they might borrow also for consumption purposes. And the extent to which they will borrow and the interest rate they pay is linked to, so to speak, their time preference or their degree of impatience. Some people will borrow more because they're eager to consume more rapidly today. Others won't be so much engaged in income smoothing. But there is a sense that when people are young, they're more impatient and keener to borrow. And therefore, you could say that their internal interest rate is higher than a person who's old, who's not expecting their income to grow any future, and therefore not keen to borrow and pay interest.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Baid, and most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host 2 live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So we came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And actually, see, they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
So, as a student of economic history, I found that the most fascinating character is perhaps the Scottish economist John Law. Many words could be used to describe his life. I would not say boring is one of them. He conducted the world's first experiment with easy money, certainly debunking the myth that Scottish people should be cheap in any kind of way. Could you please tell his story? I know, we could probably do an entire episode just in John Law and his quite exhilarating life.
Yes, I mean, you could do an entire season on right. John Law.
Yes.
He's the most extraordinary figure in the entire history of finance. And when I think about him, I have to pinch myself, say, is this guy for real? Have we made him up? So John Law is the son, born in the late 17th century, is the son of an Edinburgh goldsmith. And bear in mind that goldsmiths at that time were not just merely selling sort of gold and silverware, but they were the early bankers. They were taking in people's silver and gold and lending them money with paper. So they were starting to use paper notes And then Law's father dies. When he's young, he inherits a certain amount of money. He goes to London, becomes a bit of a dandy and a fop, spends a lot of his time at the gambling tables, loses his fortune, gets into an argument with another dandy, and they have a duel, and Law kills this man in a duel. And then Law is arrested. He escapes. He escapes jail, is sentenced to death in absence, flees to the continent of Europe, spends the next 20 years touring around Europe from one capital to another, Amsterdam, Genoa, and other places, and ends up in Paris. And over that time, he's got better at gambling. He has an extraordinary head for figures. He would probably now work for the sort of Jim Simons Renaissance technology hedge fund. You know, he has a supercomputer in his head that can calculate fine probabilities at a time when people's understandings of probabilities were a bit less sophisticated than today. He then develops an interest, well, over the course of his years in exile, he develops an interest in, as say, economics, or in particular, he proposes a land bank, a bank that would lend money against land. And he also writes a famous pamphlet called Money and Trade Considered, in which he argues that money, that at the time would have been considered a precious metal like gold and silver, was not an object that was exchanged in value, but merely was just a yardstick of value. And if money is just a yardstick of value rather than something inherently valuable in itself, then there's no need to have gold or silver backing money as we see today. So Law is the first, so to speak, monetarist economist. He believes that if you replace gold and silver currency with a paper currency, you can bring interest rates down. And he believes that if you print more money, what we would call sort of boost the money supply, that you will bring economic prosperity. So those are the ideas he's formed. He goes to France. He presents himself to the regent of France after the death of the old king, Louis XIV, in 1715. And he says to the regent, can I start a private bank in France? And the regent gives him permission to do so. He then takes over a trading company in France. And that trading company is then merged with a number of other, with all France's foreign trading companies. It also acquires the contract to raise taxes in France. It acquires the French mint. It acquires the tobacco monopoly. And, you know, its most famous possession is the so-called Louisiana Company, which laid claim to half the current landmass of the United States. So this is, by any measure, an extraordinary, extensive holding company. But the Law's not finished. He then says to the regent, I want to turn my private bank, a bank which was in a way conventional that issued notes that could be exchanged for gold, into a central bank or national bank that was called the Banque Royale. And this is in early 1719. He then goes for broke by issuing paper currency and withdrawing gold and silver from circulation. And there's a massive increase in the money supply over the course of 1719, roughly the doubling of the money in circulation. And interest rates come down. They in the early part of the decade, they were about 8% in France. And they fell to 2% and sometimes a bit below 2%. And here you see, we witnessed in recent years, people valuing stocks, shares, off the level of interest rates. So when interest rates are low, they feel that a high valuation is justified for their stock. And that was the case with Mississippi Company, which this enormous business that went up, started to trade on a price earnings ratio of 50 times, which is roughly 3.5 times the long-term average of the US stock market. And that PE of 50 times is equal to a dividend yield of 2%, which is the same as the current prevailing interest. Now, Law, the final sort of, his final act is to offer to take over for the Mississippi Company, to take over the entire French national debt. And he gets the bondholders, the people, the government creditors, to convert their credit into Mississippi shares. And to keep the Mississippi shares high during this conversion, he prints money and uses the money to buy the Mississippi Company shares. So this, as I say, is very like a quantitative easing operation, what we would call quantitative easing operation, where a central bank is going out and buying debt, or in this case, shares in the company that is acquiring the debt, in order to keep interest rates down. And there occurs during this period an extraordinary speculative, and the Mississippi share price rises 20-fold, and a large number of enormous fortunes are made. And this is a period in which the term millionaire is first coined, a French word. So Paris is teeming with millionaires, and Law and people come in from all over Europe to try and buy shares in the Mississippi Company. And little bubbles appear in other markets, you know, in London, in Amsterdam, in Lisbon. So this is also the sort of first, not exactly globe bubble, but sort of European-wide speculative mania. And Law himself, by his own reckoning, has become the richest man who ever lived in the space of a very short period of time. And he's deemed to be, he's also appointed French finance minister and is considered, you know, the greatest statesman and most powerful statesman in Europe. So this is an extraordinary achievement, if you think about it, for a man who, you know, starts out in life as a bankrupt murderer to become this great figure. And then it all falls to pieces. It falls to pieces because inflation enters the system. Not the asset price inflation that everyone likes, but the widespread in commodity and food prices that creates what we would call today a cost of living crisis. And Law then, share price, the Mississippi Company starts to sort of wobble a bit. People start selling Mississippi Company shares and trying to translate their wealth into something more secure. And another sort of English word, or at least financial word, coined at the time, was realization, to realize your profits, to make real. It's an interesting term because if you think of it during bubbles, the very notion of a bubble is that the wealth is chimerical, isn't really of any substance. So to realize your profit is to take something that has sort of perhaps no value or dubious value and turn it into something real. Anyhow, so people realize their profits. Then the scheme falls to pieces, and Law then has to choose, is he going to carry on inflating or is he going to sort of put his foot on the brakes? And he chooses to deflate the currency or some of the currency from circulation, and the whole Mississippi bubble collapses and Law has to flee the country. In the space of 18 months, he goes from a projector into the world's richest man ever, and then to having to flee, leaving behind his wife and daughter and his fortune. And then the rest of his life, he really spends on the road, going from one country to another, ending up in Venice 8 or 9 years later, where he goes back to his old gambling and apparently seems to earn a sort of decent sum of money offering people games of dice. So he has, as you say, a pretty eventful life.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
You know, he's such a fascinating person, and he is a person, like, whenever you read books about economic history, he is usually always there. And I have to say that what you do in your book is perhaps the best I've read about John Law. It's so fascinating the way that you tell his story. And one thing I always think about whenever I read about John Law is, do you think he truly believed his system would work?
Yes, I think so. There is an interview, I think I cite, where a French ambassador visits him in Venice towards the end of his life, and Law still seems to be convinced in the viability of his plans. As I say, the first monetarist, the first fiat money central banker. And one thing we know about fiat money central bankers is they don't always, when they make mistakes, confess to their errors. So there's something quite dogged about him. I think he was way too ambitious, moved far too quickly, and didn't particularly have an eye for the details. One biographer says that Law's scheme was the most ambitious economic experiment before the Russian Revolution. And I think that's a fair description. But go back to the way I'm trying to write it. You're right, you know, many people have written about Law, so it's not exactly the unknown story. What I'm trying to do is to show how Law is one of his prime motivations is to bring down the interest rate. So he is, as another biographer said, a low interest rate advocate, and he succeeds in his aim through monetary policy. And the modern monetary economists look back at Law and they say, well, Law provided the framework for modern central banking. And these comments were being made over the course of the last decade, at the time of the quantitative easing and so forth. What I found rather extraordinary is there you have it, that Law has, you know, the first great experiment in quantitative easing to revive an economy and to bring down interest rates that ends in the most phenomenal disaster. And our modern central bankers were either wittingly or unwittingly following Law, but seemed to pay no attention to the fact that the system ended with a resounding failure.
It is very interesting to think about. And he was just so smart. And like you alluded to, he might be too smart for his own good. It's so interesting how his scheme was in many ways designed to alleviate the French nobles that were heavily indebted, Boros. And here we are. Let me leave it at that. But Edward, you compared the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September 2008 to be somewhat similar to the French economy after the death of Louis XIV, a toxic mixture of deflation, high unemployment, and soaring government debt. And it seems like monetary policymakers respond to the conditions by taking the lead from Law's copybook. And you already sort of like alluded to some of that before in your response, but could you paint some color around how come? How can we connect those two stories?
Well, the Louis XIV, the so-called Sun King, had a very long reign and got France into huge debt because he was constantly engaged in warfare with Britain and Holland, other places, and very extravagant. And so at the time of his death, there were a huge amount of debt. I think the French debt was about equivalent of 100% of GDP, of French GDP. And the debts were trading at a discount to their face value. And the country, as you say, was depressed and the price level was falling. And Law's idea, so you had this sort of bad debt, deflation, and economic depression, and a large, not just bad debts, but a large mountain of debt. And Law's idea is that this can all be cured by waving a monetary wand. And I think, you know, he then really, as I have said before, when he then founds the Royal Bank and issues paper money, he sets up the progression from a gold-backed currency to a pure paper currency, what we call a fiat currency. People who speculated in the Mississippi Company and so on, you could say that they're envisaging a world in which, you know, the riches of the United States come forth, or they're envisaging a world of paper money and manipulated interest rates. But in fact, these things, the speculators often see the future. They draw a distant future into the present. And in this case, the, you know, obviously it took a while for, you know, the US to, you know, the American riches to be established, but also fiat money didn't really become established until 71, when the US brought the post-war Bretton Woods currency system to an end. So Law was, you know, almost 250 years ahead of his time in that respect. And I think that, you know, there is, you know, as I say, to go back to it, one of the things that we know about fiat money is it has an inherently inflationary aspect to it. You know, the gold dollar, the dollar was worth, an ounce of gold was worth just, I think, around $23-$24 up till 1933. And now, you know, it's probably around sort of $1,800, $1,800 or $1,900 to an ounce. So you can see huge collapse in the value of money. And I think that Law's inflation, and what I think what Law does is he encourages people to think that you can use money to dispel your economic problems. But it would appear to me that the inevitable consequence of that is that you depreciate the value of your currency. And that really is shown in his own period, but then, you know, course of the 20th century, and then as, you know, as we're experiencing again today.
Just one quick note on Louis XIV, the Sun King. It was said that he used wine in his fountains whenever he was having his elaborate parties. And I want to use that as a segue to the next question, because one person who probably, I don't know if he would even be drinking wine, but definitely not having in his fountains, would be John Bull. And our audience might or might not be familiar with John Bull. He is the personification of British common sense. And we know that John Bull can stand a great deal, but he cannot stand 2%. So former East India Company Dr. John Fullerton, who turned banker, claimed that 2% was the tipping point into financial folly. Looking back at the recent yields, so more last year perhaps than here in 2022, I just find that to be a quite interesting statement. Could you please talk to us about the psychology of the 2% tipping point?
So that 2% tipping point, as you mentioned, was first described by a very obscure figure called John Fullerton, who no one would have heard of. But people do, who know a bit about financial history, are aware of the most famous 19th century financial journalist, editor of The Economist, called Walter Badgett. And Walter Badgett, he comes from a banking family, not far from where I live in Somerset. And so he knew about banking, knew about finance, and he went and he became editor of the Economist. And Badgett noted that, and I think he borrowed from this fellow Fullerton, that the speculative manias and lending crazes tended to coincide with periods of low interest rates. And it was he who coined the phrase, which he repeats again and again in his writings, John Bull can stand many things, but he cannot stand 2%. And then Badgett elaborates, faced with a loss of income, people will do foolish things to make good, and they will engage in speculations, into, you know, canal speculations or railway speculations. He says, he makes a good point at Badger, where he says, people, when interest rates come down, you must either be, the investor must either be less poor, less rich, or less safe. In other words, there is a trade-off between risk and return. And what we find, and this is what modern research confirms, is that the periods of low interest rates do encourage people to take more risk. And in fact, the recent research suggests it's not 2% yield, but actually a 3% yield that is the threshold. And we see, and as I describe in the book, you know, in the low rates of interest that prevailed after the global financial crisis, the lowest interest rates in five millennia, all sorts of risk were taken. I also cite a slightly earlier writer on economics, an Italian called Ferdinando Galliani. And Galliani has an interesting definition of interest as being the price of anxiety or the price of risk. So you see there is a, and that's one of the key functions of interest that I think is misunderstood by the policymakers, because they think you can lower the interest rate, like a lever, in order to encourage people to borrow more and to you know, bring deflation to an end, to lower unemployment. But if you're playing around with the price of risk, you're also going to be unwittingly encouraging a buildup of risk in the system, and you probably won't know where that risk is building up. So Badgett, I think, deserves great credit for making this early connection. And I have a chapter on early connection between interest and speculative booms or bad lending, not just bubbles in stocks, but also foreign lending booms as well. And I have a chapter sort of showing how that pattern played itself out over the course of the 19th century.
It's difficult to have an episode about economic history without talking about the great economist, John Maynard Keynes. I just finished The Letters from Nick Sleep, which is a brilliant British investor. And he actually mentioned John Maynard Keynes. And he said that allegedly one of the last things he said before he died was that he had a deep regret of not drinking more champagne while he had the chance. That was not what the question was about. It was just a wonderful anecdote. But even the great economist, John Maynard Keynes, seemed to have changing thoughts on what economists call the natural level of interest. Could you please, Edward, explain to us what is that concept, and would you argue that it's relevant to manage the monetary policy of today's economy?
It's a thorny problem, the question of what's called a natural rate of interest. If you look at the writings of early economists in the 17th century, they're tending to, you remember you mentioned Queen Elizabeth's statute on usury that fixed the maximum rate of interest that was charged in the country. And in the 17th century, there were a lot of debates about should the usury level be brought lower and lower, or should the market be free to determine, borrowers and lenders free to determine what rate of interest charge. Now that I think is the early formulation of a natural rate of interest. It's the rate, you know, if you go and buy, I don't know, a packet of matches, the price you pay is the natural price for a packet of matches, because you don't have to buy that packet of matches and the seller doesn't have to sell it to you. So it's set in the market. It then becomes more complicated. It becomes an idea of monetary economists, in particular, the great Swedish economist, Knut Wicksell, who writing in the late 19th, early 20th century. And Wicksell suggests a natural rate of, he has a rather complicated view. He says the natural rate of interest is the return on capital of an economy without money. And then he says, if you sort of superimpose money on the system, the rate of interest will reflect that return on capital. He then says, you can tell the natural interest rate. You can't observe it directly, which is one of the problems of the natural interest rate, but you can infer it from whether there is inflation or deflation in the economy. So Wicksell says, if the central bank is keeping interest rates too low, then, and inflation follows, then the interest rate, the policy rates are below the natural rate. He says then, if the price level is falling and you have deflation, then Wicksell says, then the policy rates are above the natural rate. And this is a view held by modern monetary policymakers and central bankers. And it was the view that was the rationale for these extremely low and negative interest rates in the last decade, and also for the quantitative easing. And I argue somewhat differently. I say, forget about inflation and deflation. You don't know what the natural rate is, but there are other things that would be telling you, aside from inflation, that the policy rate was below, so to speak, the natural rate. And you would observe, the things I observe are the asset price inflation that we've just talked about, credit booms, and so forth. Those would be the, to my mind, the indications that the policy rate has been set too low. So I say that you can tell the natural rate by its absence, because bad things, so to speak, or dangerous things are happening in the financial system. So one thing I should add to that is, I didn't mention the misallocation of capital. If you have interest rates at too low a level, you will have a misallocation of capital into projects that won't deliver a satisfactory return. Another sort of grave problem from interest rates being too low.
Yeah, let's talk a bit more about that, because I think our listeners are quite familiar with Schumpeter's evolutionary process of created destruction. So to your point before, why have the low interest rate put a brake on the process by having now unnatural selection and capital destruction?
Well, I mean, I discovered the writings of a late 19th century American economist who's president of Yale, called Arthur Hadley. And Hadley actually suggests that interest rates lead to encourage the process of natural selection. If you think about it, we often talk about the interest rate as a hurdle rate for an investment. So if you will, the higher the hurdle rate, only the more efficient companies can get over a high hurdle rate. Now, Schumpeter, the Austrian economist, in his way, perhaps the second most colorful economist after John Law, and actually just as brilliant as Law. But Schumpeter has this notion, famous notion of creative destruction. In Schumpeter's world, profits are always dwindling away and the economy is sort of moving towards sclerosis. So you need a constant flow of companies being created and other companies being destroyed, and innovation and entrepreneurs. And I argue, this is not a fashionable position, and it's very much against the view of the Keynesian economists, who tend to dominate the world of academia and policymaking, that the low interest rates of recent years have impeded the creative destruction in the economy. And you can see that by the relatively low levels of bankruptcies that occurred after the global financial crisis in both Europe and in the United States. And then later by the proliferation of so-called zombie companies. These were companies that couldn't afford to pay their interest. I mean, their profits were not large sufficient to cover their interest charges at a time when interest rates themselves were at historically low level. And I also argue that this lack of creative destruction then has an impact on productivity, and therefore, and the lack of productivity feeds through to low wage growth. So people have argued, the conventional central banker view or the establishment view is that becomes a justification for lower interest rates. At one stage, I think the former Fed chair Ben Bernanke, in around, say, 2018, responding to low productivity figures, he says this is dovish news for interest rates. Whereas, in other words, that interest rates will come down because productivity slipped. I'm reversing the order. I'm saying the low interest rates appear to be actually leading to low productivity. And then you get a sort of, horrible feedback loop, because then the low productivity feeds back into the low interest rates. So I think one of the problems, and I think one of the problems that besets modern economics, that in my experience, people who've actually worked in financial markets as investors and bankers and so forth, where with practical experience, realize the sort of feedback between finance, between our perceptions or policies and the financial system and the economy. And there are these constant feedbacks, what George Soros calls reflexivity, whereas the academic economist nowadays tends to just have an abstract view of the economy that without really any impact of financial and monetary policy on this abstract view of the economy. It's a view that is extraordinarily far away from the reality that one can observe.
Edward, I wanted to end this interview with a wonderful quote from the very beginning of your book. And the quote goes like this: "Our earth is degenerate in these latter days. Bribery and corruption are common. Children no longer obey their parents. Every man wants to write a book. And the end of the world is evidently approaching." Now, one might think that this is the headline of today's newspaper.
Yeah, I must stop you there, Stig, because that quote comes from Homer and Sylla's famous History of Interest Rates, which is the Bible of giving you the five millennia history of. And my book is about interest. It obviously writes about it, and Homer and Sylla writing a history of interest. So they cite this quote, so I couldn't resist putting it in. But actually, I did a bit of research on it. And it's almost certainly apocryphal. In fact, at one stage, I was going to use as epigraphs at the beginning of each chapter apocryphal quotes about interest. Like, for instance, the claim that Einstein said that interest was the eighth wonder of the world, which Einstein never actually said. It's so perfect, that this apocryphal quote, that I couldn't resist putting it in slightly as a sort of inside joke to Dick Sylla. Sidney Homer's dead, but Dick Sylla I know, and I thought it might amuse him if I replicated it. There's a very good website called Quote Investigator. If you ever think a quote is too good to be true, you have to go to the Quote Investigator website, where the writer will say, where they research the quotes to see what they have. So it could be true, it could be a serum, but it's probably just made up sometime in the 20th century. But it does seem to apply today. I mean, not least, me publishing a book, and you try and put a book out today, and the publisher says, 60,000 books are published in England every year. And you're thinking, wow, that's slightly more books than we probably need.
It's so wonderful that you would say that, because I can't help but being captivated. Whenever I read that on the very first pages of the book, I was thinking, this has to be a wonderful book. Just the last question I wanted to ask you here before I let you go, I want to be very respectful of your time, but you started The Price of Time from the origins of Mesopotamia up to today What is the most surprising fact that you learned on this journey writing your wonderful book?
I think, if I can call it a fact, is that over the course of writing the book, I came to realize how central the interest rate was to all of human life, in the sense of putting a price on time, but in particular to the capitalist system. Because, as I say somewhere, you know, if you have what we call a piece of capital, is something generating income, and unless you apply a discount rate, an interest rate, a capitalization rate to that income, you can't have a price. You would have an infinite price. I think one of the 17th century economists said that, you know, without interest, there would be no difference between the value of an acre of land and a value and you know, 2,000 acres of land. Interest is we have lost sight of this most extraordinarily important, the most important economic, if you want to call it, for want of a better word, variable. And because we lost sight of what it did and the richness of its functions, what my friend Jim Grant calls interest the universal price. Because we've lost a sense of the universality of interest, we have, I think, you know, we have gone down a pretty bad route. And we're at the moment, you know, with, you know, obviously with inflation coming and interest rates rising and the financial markets cracking, we're sort of beginning to recognize the errors of our way.
And here we are today. Perhaps that should be the last famous words. The name of the book is The Price of Time. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, Edward. Would you like to say a few words about the book here before we round off the interview?
My definition of a good bookshop will be my book is the sale in it.
Well said, well said. Well, Edward, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thanks very much, T.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to subscribe to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network and learn how to achieve financial independence. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.